whole story of Exodus, the Passover, is actually a sort of a love relationship and the connection between God's love for his people and his calling out of people and making a people, which is spelled out during the Exodus story,
okay,
is directly linked to God's
absolutely
love relationship with Israel.
So that is one of the reasons.
Many chapters actually retell the story in the Psalms.
What do you mean, retell the story in the Psalms?
What happened in the Exodus, how they came out of Egypt, Psalm 105.
Yes, we have like six historical psalms that retrace the story of the Exodus in the wilderness. And like I said, because it is such a pivotal national watershed moment, it's remembered in the poetry a lot. And part of God's story. And of course, God is a poet. He likes art. And a lot of our Bible, if you're reading it like a newspaper, you're going to miss things because it's not meant to be a newspaper. When you write poetry, it's not a newspaper. Some of the Bible reads a bit more like a newspaper. If you read Chronicles, for instance, not so poetic. So you have to read each text the way it was intended. Song of Songs, of course, is a song or a poem, which in Hebrew is basically the same word. There is, we'll flesh out each of these ideas as we go along. There is even a rabbinic interpretation that as the children of Israel are passing through the Red Sea, you know, right after that, what song do they sing? Do you remember?
The Song of the Sea.
Song of the Sea, the horse and the rider who's thrown into the sea. So there's a Song of Moses, it's called, or Song of the Sea, even Song of Miriam. But there's also a rabbinic idea that they sang Song of Songs as they're passing through the sea or right afterwards in addition, which is very interesting. Last night in my Haggadah, the very front page, you know what a Haggadah is? It means the telling of the story. And so on Passover, the whole point is to tell the story of the Exodus, right? And so it's called Haggadah, to tell. So right as I opened my little booklet of the Haggadah, the first thing there was a little selection of Song of Songs about how the trees are bursting forth and it's spring and it's budding. So another connection, you could say, besides this relationship that we'll get into more, is just the fact that they're both spring, right? You have a lot of imagery in the Song of Songs about spring and blossoms and blooming and new life. And so that would tie into Passover, which is spring, and Song of Songs, which is spring. And even Passover, you know, you have a lamb. All the lambs are giving birth right now, too. So you have kind of the beginning of new lambs, and you also have the agricultural beginning of new blossoms. And if you go around this country right now, everything's just blooming and beautiful. So all the spring symbolism definitely connects them, and the love relationship connects them. So why don't you open up to Song of Songs? Let me see here. You can open up to the beginning. There is one other connection. Maybe we'll read to verse 10 and see if you guys see another connection between Song of Songs and Exodus. If you could, everyone read a couple verses and we'll just head down this way of Song of Songs 1.
Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Because of the fragrance of your good ointments, your name is ointment poured forth. Therefore the virgins love you. Draw me away, we will run after you. The king has brought me into his chambers. We will be glad and rejoice in you. We will remember your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you.
I am really dark, but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Do not gaze at me because I am dark, because the sun has looked upon me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I will not kept.
Tell me, the whom I love, why grace your flock and why grace the sheep at midday? Why should I make a veiled woman beside the flocks of your friends? If you do not know, most beautiful women follow the tracks of the sheep and graze your young goats by the wings of the shepherd.
What? Follow the. I didn't hear.
If you do not know, most beautiful women follow the tracks of sheep.
Okay. Go ahead.
I liken you, my darling, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariot horses. Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your neck with strings and jewels. We will make you earrings of gold instead of silver.
While the king was at his banqueting table, my nard gave forth its fragrance. My beloved is like a fragrant pouch of myrrh, spreading the night between my breasts. My beloved is like a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyards of Engedi.
Mm-hmm.
How beautiful you are, my God. Oh, how beautiful your eyes are doves. How handsome you are, my beloved. Oh, how charming. And our bed is burning. The beams of your house are cedars. Our rafters are firs.
I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. Like a lily among the thorns is my darling among the maidens. Like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my lover among the young men. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste.
The beloved of my lover, he brought me into the banquet hall, and he looked at me lovingly, sustained me with raisin cakes, filled me with apples, for I am faint with love.
Okay, we'll stop there for a second. What translation were you reading? Net? Yes, I really like that they changed the translation there. Do any of you have his banner over me is love? That's an older translation. Do you know the song? He brought me to his banqueting table, his banner over me is love. Yeah, and you're like, right. We all know the song and you're like, what does that mean? His banner over me is love? What, if he likes me, he's going to come put a banner over me? Like, what does that mean? So, it's interesting because we have this word degel that's very rare in the Bible. Today it means flag. And so, it was some type of flag or banner in the Bible as well. But, some words are homonyms with other words. And it appears, based on cognate languages, that this word is more connected to a gaze, looking at somebody. We have, even in Hebrew today, we have the word dagul. It's a prominent figure. It's someone high up in society. Ish dagul. And dagul has the same letters as degel. And so we have a remnant of this other understanding of like, oh, if he's a prominent figure, he's someone I can see or look up to. And so it seems like this is actually his glance at me is love. His look at me is love.
His gaze of love.
His gaze of love. So let's see. What did mine say again? That was verse 4?
Yeah.
He looked at me lovingly. Yeah. For me, okay, I'm going to be a stickler here. His look at me was love, I would rather have, because is love is more powerful than lovingly to me somehow. It's like a stronger metaphor if you're going to get into poetry. But anyway, his look at me is love makes sense. You're all sitting around a banquet table, and someone looks at you, and you can tell that they love you.
That's true.
So I'm glad to see it's finally reflected in a translation.
Yesterday we had a red banner, a red thing right across the room.
And that was supposed to be for this verse?
It was, yes. His banner over to me.
So what are you going to do next year?
We do it every year.
Oh, yeah?
We do it every year, yeah.
Regardless of whether this is banner or look? It won't change it. Well, you could say it's the blood covering anyway,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's exactly.
Yeah, that's
it,
right.
Yeah.
And that is love.
That's right.
So, what did you catch as we are reading through this poetry? Obviously, it's poetry between lovers, right? And if we kept reading, if you didn't already, at some point you would blush. I hope. I think. Because it's describing love between a man and a woman that's very intimate and very real. So we're going to go back to two questions. Why do we read this at Passover? And then I guess the bigger question is, what's it doing in the Bible? And if you can answer both of those, there's kind of a similar thing behind them. So what did you see in these verses that might connect to Passover, other than what we've already talked about?
I was suddenly struck with this, which I never...
Can I erase this now? Is this in everyone's mind? Okay.
I'll take the
photograph. Hold on.
What struck me, Sharon, was the chains of gold and the ornaments of gold and the studs of silver. Because if you remember, they... Out of the Passover story was this whole business of getting the jewels out of the people wanted to get rid of them so fast they gave them all their jewels.
Yeah.
And I'd never noticed that before.
No,
I think the key verse is just how beautiful you are, my darling. You're just talking about the beauty and the love.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
You've got that. Good job. So there is actually mention of Pharaoh, horses of Pharaoh.
Mm-hmm. Working in vineyards that in the expense of your own, working other people's vineyards in the expense of your own.
Oh, that's an interesting one. So a form of slavery, you could say, working in others. And of course, the vineyard metaphor is herself, right? So she's taking care of other people instead of taking care of her own beauty or her own self. And that's true. There's only a certain amount of hours in the day, you know? So quite frankly, I'm lucky if I brush my hair because I got three little kids that run around and their hair is never brushed either. It's just like getting clothes on them is about what I can handle. So when she's taking care of other people, she's not able to take care of herself. Like Cinderella and, I don't know, all those other people out there. And
Rapunzel.
Maybe the slaves felt that way too. Where is the vineyard an image of Israel?
Isaiah 5.
Very good. Isaiah 5. So that also connects you to Israel as a vineyard. So again, you have this, Israel is a woman, and Israel is a vineyard. And tell me this metaphor, where else do you see it in the Bible? God, a picture of God as husband and Israel as wife. Throw out some, Hosea, great. His whole book is based on that. I'm just going to put them up here. Hosea, you could say chapter 2, I mean, the whole book. But maybe chapter 2 lines up with us as well. Because what does Hosea say to Israel about she's been, you know the story where Hosea was commanded to go take an unfaithful woman to be his wife? And why?
Because Israel had been unfaithful.
Because Israel had been unfaithful. And so what's the solution in chapter 2? What does Hosea say to Israel? I'm going to lead you back to
your husband.
But in the metaphor, there's a metaphor where God will lead this woman back to
his ways.
Okay, you're getting too... okay, I'm not being clear enough. Back to the desert. The desert. Because that was the time of their courtship. Was it the desert? Let's see if we can find that. Who can beat me? Hosea 2. I think it's Hosea 2, am I?
Thou hast moved me to the desert.
Yeah.
14, I think, is the moment of the song. Thou hast moved me to the desert. Valley of Achor.
Okay. 14, there you go.
It says, I will make her like a desert.
Okay. It also says, I will make her like a desert. That's another place, but...
But what you're saying is that the courtship was in the desert.
Yes.
But where are we with... Where are we with the connection with Passover? Because in Passover, they're in Egypt, which is not technically desert.
No, but it's Passover is the beginning of the Exodus and the whole wilderness experience, which is kind of telescoped together.
Right.
So, in the English, I will, however, in the future, I will allure her. He's going to seduce her, allure her. I will lead her back into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. So you have that image of lovers there. From there, I will give back her vineyards to her. So that's kind of like this reversal. And turn the valley of trouble into an opportunity for hope.
Where are you reading?
I'm reading Hosea 2, 14 and 15 in English. Now, what does opportunity for hope, what is that in Hebrew? Petach Tikva. Has anyone been there today? There's a town named after it. Entrance of Hope. Okay. There she will sing. Okay, again, poetry. Sing. As she did when she was young. When she came up from the land of Egypt. Okay. At that time, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You will never again call me my master. Okay, unfortunately, this does not translate well. Because they're playing on the Hebrew words here. There's two ways you can say husband. One, you can just say my man, ishi. And he says, in that day, you're going to call me ishi. The other way is to say ba'ali, which technically means my master. Today, it's still used as husband. But what does ba'ali sound like?
Ba'al.
Ba'al. There is a Canaanite god, Ba'al. So when God says, you're not going to call me your husband, you're going to call me your husband. He's using words like, you're going to call me the word that has nothing to do with Baal, because I'm not Baal. And the whole point of this is she has been unfaithful by chasing other gods. So chasing Baal. So he can play on those two things in Hebrew. My husband and my master doesn't really express all of that, but you would have to use a footnote there anyway. And then immediately the next verse, verse 17, for I will remove the names of Baal, of the Baal idols from your lips, so that you will never again utter their names. Okay. So we have this image here in Hosea of the wilderness experience being like a courtship.
And how verses 19 and 20 make it even clearer.
Verses 19 and 20.
Yeah. I will betroth you to me forever.
Yes, yes.
I will betroth you to you in
righteousness and justice.
In loving kindness and mercy. I will betroth three times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord.
Instead of saying, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, saying, I will betroth you, betroth you, betroth you. Yeah. So you have this covenant. Now, in Song of Songs, there's no mention of covenant, but it's a whole picture of relationship. And if you go back to the big picture metaphor, if you have Exodus from Egypt, that's like God pulling them out, and then you have like this new being, this new entity. They're becoming a nation, and then part of that leads up to Sinai, where they have a covenant, right? And so you could see this as a betrothal leading to some kind of marriage, right? That's like the big picture that you're looking at. And
what we realized yesterday was that the Exodus story really begins with God making a covenant promise to Abraham. You wouldn't be in the where you are now if you hadn't started with this covenant.
Right.
So the whole message of the covenant.
Yes. God is a God of covenant. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, and I will engage you in faith, and you will know the Lord. Okay, verse 22 of Hosea. This is Hosea's whole thing. He's always talking about know the Lord, know the Lord. And again, Hebrew's going to help you. You don't have to know Hebrew to understand the Bible and have a good relationship with God, but it can add depth. And the reason I say that is there's so much poetry, and Hosea is a poet. And when he says, know the Lord, that is a powerful image. Very powerful. Why? First of all, he has this metaphor of husband and wife, God and Israel. But when Adam knew Eve, what happened?
They had a baby.
So do you understand what know means? When he's saying know the Lord, he's saying be intimate with God. I mean, it's very powerful language, especially when you realize that part of the other cults going on to Baal were fertility worship. So instead of sleeping in a fertility cult, know me. Now, physically, clearly, there was no kind of sexual anything related to worship of God, right? We're talking purely metaphoric, purely spiritual. But he's using that image because it's so powerful and humans can relate to it so well. The deep yearning for something, hunger, those are images we can relate to. And so to put God in that place of like, know the Lord, it's very strong. And you will know me. It says in, sorry, my verse 22 is your verse
20.
There you go.
And you shall know the Lord.
You shall know the Lord.
There's a connection there too with Passover, because the whole thing about I will make you my people and you will know me. You will worship me. I'm going to bring you out that you, my people, that you might serve me, worship me.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, we're.
And that
Jesus.
And that Egypt, everyone will know that God is a God of Israel.
That's right.
So it's kind of like you're. We're going. The result is that we know the Lord. Now, you also notice in Hosea that because of this betrothal, because of this relationship and knowing God, then he does bless him with fertility. Look in verse 23 in English, verse 21. I will respond to the sky, and the sky will respond to the ground, and the ground will respond to the grain, the new wine, and the olive oil. And they will respond to God plants. They're interpreting the word Yisrael, which is God will sow seed, kind of. So you have this picture of rain and growth, which is what's going to go on right now in April. Anyway, this is all to say this image is not just a made-up image of later Judaism. You find it in the Bible already. Where else do you find mention of this kind of God's the husband, Israel's the wife? Give me some other prophets. What?
Is Isaiah?
Well, yeah, we did mention the vineyard in Isaiah.
Yeah.
So let's put, Isaiah 5 is up here. But who's Isaiah's, who's the other big one?
Jeremiah.
Remember, he's got things about, is it, give me the chapter, 29?
There's also the second part of Isaiah, where it says Jerusalem will not be Azubah,
yeah.
Be'ula.
You're right, it's all in there. Can you give me a reference? Okay. You're right. There is, and I'm sure there's verses almost in all the prophets. You could almost find little verses here and there. But the big ones, Jeremiah says, I'm going to give you your certificate of divorce. I had a teacher in high school claim that that's why God no longer had a covenant with Israel. And I'm like, well, what happened to a chapter later where he says, I'm taking you back? Doesn't, what?
And
you're
going to
quote the one chapter and not the new covenant?
I will make a new covenant.
Anyway.
It's Isaiah 54.
54, there you go. And Jeremiah, also Ezekiel. Ezekiel 16, you're not supposed to read until you're 30.
Whoa.
Yeah. It's, what do you call that? R30. For those reasons. It's pretty graphic. You miss some of that in translation, most likely. Ezekiel 16.
We're all rushing to look at it.
We're all rushing to look at it, just like Song of Songs.
I'm over age.
In seventh grade, you're like,
I'm over.
Okay. Like
the
verse 6.
Is, you know, we don't understand it.
We don't understand it.
Well, I mean, I'm, until you were saying just now, I honestly don't know that I looked at it any sort of way about, and I'm a midwife, you'd think I'd understand something about birth and whatever.
Yeah, well, it kind of goes quickly from birth, if that is birth, or if it's puberty blood, I don't know. In verse 6, I passed by you and saw you kicking around helplessly in your blood.
Right.
I said to you, as you lay there in your blood, live. I said to you, as you lay there in your blood, live. I made you plentiful like sprouts in a field. You grew tall and came of age so that you could wear jewelry. Your breasts had formed and your hair had grown. And it's not talking about this hair. But you were still naked and bare. Then I passed by you and watched you, noticing that you had reached the age for love. I spread my cloak over you and covered your nakedness. I swore a solemn oath to you and entered into a marriage covenant with you, declares the Sovereign Lord, and you became mine. Okay, so here Israel's described as literally a naked woman. You can't get more graphic than that. Very strong imagery, once again, of the same idea. So, it's not such a far cry, then, to read this book for Passover. And let me... So, in all these pictures in the Bible, in Ezekiel, Israel's like either this helpless woman that needs to be saved, or she's an adulteress or somehow unfaithful woman that needs to be redeemed. So you have this picture of not only is it marriage, but God is willing to redeem her. He's wanting to redeem her. He's wanting to make her beautiful and make her this bride again, no matter like where she's been. And so that's also part of this imagery. And if he's been like that in the past, if he did the Exodus once, he can do it again. And so the picture of salvation is the same as, you know, we come dirty, we're not so pretty, and God will make us a bride. And of course, we have that carrying on to the new covenant as well. So, but let's, in the first century, rabbis were discussing which books were canonical. Which books are we really going to say this is inspired by God to be our measure for life? And they had a few questions of a couple books. What books do you think they had questions about?
Esther.
Well, maybe. Luther had more of a question on that one.
Oh,
yeah, there was. Why? Yeah. Why in the book of Esther?
Because God's not mentioned.
God's not mentioned.
Theoretically.
However, when you read it detailed, you see all these connections to biblical text that the not mentioning God was on purpose. And if that's the case, he's still there. He's just behind the scenes. Yeah. But you have to be artistic to see it. And so people who approach the Bible and they want it not artistic, well, you have a problem. but the other two biggies were Ecclesiastes, which we have up here, and Song of Songs. Because it is love poetry. It's a man and a woman. And you see erotic symbolism. And so people are saying, wait, how can this be in the Bible, right? So who do you think, who supported, what, you had a question?
Why Ecclesiastes?
Because there's not really much mention of covenant with God or some of the other big themes that you see in biblical books. It comes across as a little bit secular.
But at the end, though, does it be said like?
Oh, no, there's a redeeming verse in there. But out of 12 chapters, there's a redeeming verse. So people just, it was a little bit of a question mark.
Okay.
Like, is this really... Because there's a lot of statements in there that are like, whoa, everything's meaningless? Like,
poetry.
It is poetry again, and it is deep writing, and it's part of wisdom literature, but it just had a different genre, a different character enough that people just questioned a little bit, and then they decided, no, this is canonical. And the same for Song of Songs. Who really pushed Song of Songs? What rabbi? Do you know the rabbi? Akiva, yes.
Oh, really?
He was a Song of Song pusher. He said, yes. Well, there's two things. Some people were reading Song of Songs at drinking parties because it's erotic poetry, so let's read it. And he says, heaven forbid, this is Akiva. Wait, I don't have that quote. He had a quote that said, if you read it at a drinking party, you should be cut off from the world to come. Which is basically an evangelical talk, you're not going to be saved. He was adamant that Song of Songs is not just a secular poem. This is a poem between God and Israel. And that's how you need to read it, and it's got to be in the Bible. And so he said, no one in Israel ever suggested that the Song of Songs was not canonical, for the entire world is not as precious as the day on which the Song of Songs was given to Israel. For all of the writings are holy, and Song of Songs is the holy of holies. So it compares to the tabernacle. And possibly. Job is also another wisdom. Wisdom literature does have a different kind of nature to it. But there is, because of the envelope story, there is much more of a divine interpretive framework for you, and so it didn't cause quite the questioning as some of the other books.
It does spell out pretty obviously. I mean, it's not poetry in that sense. I mean,
which?
Job.
Well, no, there's a narrative structure around it, and then there's a poetry.
Yeah.
The poetry is very hard to understand, both linguistically. Like, it's a dialectically, it seems a little different than standard biblical Hebrew, and in time, it may be earlier. It's hard, though, to determine. Exactly. But
in terms of content and in terms of whether or not it's included, it makes more sense because it really is a battle about is God to be trusted or...
Yeah, no, I'm so glad it was included.
Yeah.
It is such a wonderful book to encourage people because the Deuteronomic principle is if you do the right thing, you're going to be blessed. Mm-hmm. If you don't do the right thing, you're going to be cursed. So what happens when you suffer?
Yeah,
well, obviously you've done the wrong thing, right?
Yeah,
if you just apply that principle. So it'd be very easy to just point fingers and, oh, you're suffering. You must be not righteous.
Yeah.
You must have done something wrong.
Yeah.
And so what about all the righteous people suffering?
Yeah.
You know, now you feel guilty on top of your pain. And like Job is pleading, he's like, no way. I was father to the homeless. I was the one who went out there and did everything right. So it's not about that. And so Job is a wonderful comfort to righteous people who are going through a lot of suffering. You had another comment?
Yeah, so I have an Orthodox friend who told me that he believes that Job, like, that none of it happened, it's all metaphor. Is that the historic, like, Jewish interpretation?
It could be. Job is kind of set like a drama in the sense you have these long monologues in people's mouth, and it's poetic. This is an interesting question of the Bible because it doesn't say at the top of every book, this is poetry, or this is a drama, or this is this. This is historical. It just gives you the story, so you have to figure out the genre. So if you interpret it as, oh, this is just telling me history, you're going to read it a certain way. And if you come at it like, oh, this is meant to be a play, you know, you read it another way. We don't know because it's not given. But it is given in poetry.
Another way of putting that is in terms of our own mental whatevers. We read things differently. You, actually, I think, read things and you can see poetry in a way I'm absolutely lost on. And
well, yeah, I mean...
And I tend to see things, I don't quite know, historically or spiritually or relationship-wise or whatever. It doesn't really matter. But I think we all have different ways of reading stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if something is a bit baffling, we skip it or whatever.
Well, we know that the Bible is mixed, what we call genres, mixed type of literature. We know there's kind of like historical-esque writing. It's not pure history because its goal is not to tell you the events. Its goal is to get you to believe in God.
Yeah.
So we still call that historiography. So we have that on the one hand, and then we have poetry on the other, and we have wisdom. Like, Book of Proverbs is in there, right? It has all these proverbs. Well, you know, if you do this, like if you're, give me a proverb, something to the effect of, same Deuteronomic principle, if you do this, you're going to be blessed. Well, sometimes people do that and they're not blessed. Does that make that verse not true? No. Why not? Because it's a proverb. And that type of literature speaks in generalizations. So if you read it as a proverb, you accept it as truth as a proverb. Not as like this, this had to happen and has to always happen or it's not true. So it does affect how we approach books, how we see the truth of the Bible. And Job is a tricky one. So I'm just going to leave it to the side. But that is a known interpretation of it being a drama as opposed to an actual historical figure. However, there was a whole, you can find hints all through the Bible about wisdom coming from the east. And where is Job from? The Uz, Uz, the land of Uz, which is also connected to Edom, somewhere in the east. So you have this whole eastern, and Bilam was a prophet who was not from Israel. He's also from the mountains of the east. So you have this whole kind of tradition connecting wisdom and east. It was a known, kind of like we all know about Oxford and Cambridge. We all know they're respected schools. So if you wanted to go study at a respected school, you might study there. So in ancient times, you might go to the east to study wisdom and how to examine the world, both physical and spiritual. Yeah. So we'll just leave a big question mark on Job and keep going. So Akiva's pushing for Song of Songs being the holy of holy. And I see we're just about out of time anyway, so let me see. Let me kiss. We'll just focus on the first verse then. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. How do you understand this between God and Israel? So, speaking of genre, there were different rabbis approached this a little differently. And they said, well, in what context, if this is between God and Israel, when did he say this? And so, what possible context would you come up with? We've already mentioned one, at the sea, right? When they're crossing the sea, or the Exodus. What's another?
I'm not sure of the question.
When, if we're assuming that the context of Song of Song is a love song between God the husband,
oh, right,
or God the lover, and Israel, his beloved,
right,
in what context does he say, does she say, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth? What does it mean for God to kiss you? That's what I'm asking.
To demonstrate his love?
When? When in history?
God demonstrates his...
What?
Abrahamic covenant.
Okay, that's going even further back than anybody went.
When they crossed the Red Sea.
I like that. When they crossed the Red Sea, because it was so miraculous. They experienced God face to face. And not just one prophet off in a closet somewhere. The whole country. Little kids, you know,
everyone.
Working women, working men. They were there and they see this sea split in front of them for them to walk through. So because it was such a face-to-face experience with God, face-to-face, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. There you go.
You could say the same about the blood on the...
On the doorpost?
On the doorpost, because I mean that...
But they didn't see, they just, something passed over them. They didn't go out and see it.
No, but they heard the crying of what happened. They knew what
okay,
was
okay.
Up.
So,
was,
that was, you can argue that. Go
yeah,
ahead.
Okay. We saw a clip from...
The other traditional time is the giving of Torah at Mount Sinai, yeah, right? We mentioned that, when the covenant is actually made. Yeah. And today, in many cultures, when you, bride and groom, you come, you have a wedding, then what you do, the first thing after you're declared man and wife?
You kiss.
You kiss. It kind of proves we're now together. So giving the Torah at Sinai. Later on, the other options were dedicating the tabernacle, which was, again, back to this concept of Holy of Holies, when you can come and be close to God. Come close to God. And all the words for sacrificing involve bringing coming close. Not all the words, one of the words. And of course, if you have the tabernacle, you can also say Solomon's temple. So there's also a mention of doves in Song of Solomon. And there's this famous midrash about Song of Songs. Oh, my dove that is in the cleft of the rock, in the covert of the cliff, let me see your face. Let me hear your voice. For sweet is your voice and your face is lovely. That's from Song of Solomon 2:14. And so they made this whole interpretive allegory, how this dove is flying away from a hawk, but lands in a rock, and what meets it is a snake. And so that's like they're flying away from Egypt, but then they meet wilderness, and so, or the sea first. And so they scream out to their God, and God reaches down and saves them. So this image of the dove being Israel. And that ties in with the sea. Israel cries out to sea. So we're out of time. But you can read through this book today if you like and think about it as the relationship between God and Israel. And also be challenged to note both that God is willing to use very powerful metaphors and even provocative metaphors to encourage you to seek him in a very, very intimate way. And he wants to have an experience with you face to face, very real. So as you read Song of Songs, you can think about the rabbinic interpretation of God and Israel. And then later, I don't know about you, I'm not Jewish, so I'm added in. I'm grafted into the olive tree. So God wants an experience with everyone, not just Israel. But certainly he started the story with Israel to show that he's faithful to his covenants. And so I know he'll be faithful to covenant with me because he was faithful to covenant with them. Anyway, so take that home and meditate on it.
Thank you.
Shabbat shalom.